right, we have one case on our 10:30 docket, and we will call that now. Donato versus State of Texas. If the clerk will please announce counsel, who will be arguing? All right, thank you, Mr. Anton. You ready? Thank you.
May it please the court, Bruce Anton for the appellant, Rafael Donato. I've argued 5 points in the brief. In light of possible time constraints, I'm going to argue primarily the first and fifth point. The first point that I would like to bring the court's attention to is the admission of an extraneous offense, which we argue was error. I'm sure, as the court can guess, there's nothing potentially more prejudicial in a sexual assault case involving a minor than an allegation that the person has molested other children. So it's the kind of evidence that needs to be handled with the greatest sort of caution. Now, in this case, the thrust of the defense was that the girls had a sleepover and had watched a scary movie. The girl was having a bad dream. Mr. Donato went in there to quiet the girls. The girls were sleeping three in a bed. He was only in there for a brief period of time. And so given those circumstances, that there were other children in bed with the complainant, in opening statement he said that he would not have given him the opportunity to molest the child. But the main thrust of his defense was that the girl was imagining this because she was having a bad dream as a result of watching the movie. Now, I'm well aware that there are cases that say that in opening statement, if you open the door to an argument such as opportunity, that the state has right to introduce extraneous offenses. However, you have to view that through the other tests that the court has set up as a gatekeeping function, which primarily include that there has to be sufficient similarity of conduct between the extraneous offense and the act alleged at trial to prevent unfair prejudice. Now, in this case, the state seized on the word opportunity, almost as though, you know, if the defense attorney had stood up and started his argument to the in opening argument to the jury and said, I welcome the opportunity to present you here, you wonder if they wouldn't have seized on the word opportunity in that context with the same alacrity. They focus on the word. So at the end of their case, at the end of the defense case, the state comes in and they say to the judge, Your Honor, he said opportunity. They argued opportunity. Here are cases that say if you use the word opportunity, the evidence comes in. And the judge considered that, and there was a sub rosa hearing where the extraneous offense victim was examined about what her testimony would be. And that testimony was her allegations that when she was alone with Mr. Donato on previous occasions, no other children present, nobody else around, that while they were alone, he would molest her, which has got no similarity to the offense charge in this case and is irrelevant to what the defense counsel was arguing to the jury. He was not saying that he never had made a blanket statement that he never had the opportunity to molest other children or there was no opportunity for this to happen. He was saying if you've got three children in a bed in the middle of the night and he walks in for a brief period of time, you can't molest the child under those circumstances. The state presents evidence from the extraneous offense victim that, well, you know, when he's alone with another child, he might have molested her then. The court hears that evidence at the conclusion of the sub rosa hearing, lets it in only for the limited purpose of proving opportunity. Now, that's important because in the state's brief, they devote pages and pages to other reasons why this extraneous offense conduct could have been admissible. The problem with that is that the judge gave a limiting instruction at the time of the admissibility of the evidence, limiting the jury's consideration solely to opportunity. He did not permit the jury to consider it for fabrication. He did not permit the jury to consider it for identity. So what the state would have you do at this point, if you read their brief, is substitute yourself not only for the jury, but for the trial judge in arguing that this evidence...
How does it show opportunity? It just shows if he said it once, he'll do it again. How's that opportunity?
Mr. Donato's conduct?
Yeah, how does showing that he assaulted a child who was alone, how does that show opportunity to assault a child who's in a bed with two other girls?
That's precisely my argument, Your Honor, that there has to be a similarity of conduct between the offenses. If you're going to show in the way the Powell case reads, for example, which is the primary case the state cites, what you have is a defendant who says, I never had the opportunity to molest children in my trailer. And it turns out that he had allegedly molested other children in the trailer. So the extraneous offense was directly in contradiction to what he was telling the jury. Donato's defense was, there's three girls in this bed. It couldn't have happened. The state says, we think that we can prove he did it because on other occasions when there was a girl alone, he molested her. And as Justice Doffno, quite correctly points out, there's no similarity between that conduct that would make this offense more likely to have happened because of this conduct over here. They're not sufficiently similar under the governing principles of admissibility. And so the trial court abused its discretion. And this court should not take the invitation that the state is now submitting and say, well, okay, maybe it was an opportunity, maybe it was for fabrication. The jury was specifically instructed, you can't consider it for anything else other than opportunity. There's no way for that jury to reweigh the evidence and reconsider the facts of the case under the new theories that they alleged. The state was quite clear in their proffer of the evidence and their final argument. This, we're only doing this for opportunity. They could have said fabrication. They could have said identity. They could have alleged whatever other reasons they wanted for the admission of the offense. They failed to do so. The judge gave the jury a very particular limiting instruction, and I am aware of language in cases that say if evidence is admissible under any theory, the ruling stands. I'm not aware of any cases that permit the appellate court to go back and reconsider evidence in a light in which the jury was specifically instructed they could not do so. There's no precedent for that. That's a substitution of judgment that I think is impermissible. Now, the fifth point is regards the movie. And this is an interesting point because it's essentially a case of first impression, or at least I have not been able to find too many cases in the appellate realm dealing with this issue. But this is what the defense was. These three teenage girls had watched this scary movie, Paranormal Activity. Now, I've never seen it. There's advertisements now out for Paranormal Activity 4, but based on what you can see from reading the record, apparently this is a horror film where while the girl is in bed at night, she's molested by some ethereal spirit, I guess. I'm not quite certain, but that proffers in the record. And when the girl claimed she was molested, her first statement was, I was having a bad dream. And one of the girls in bed testified, one of the girls who was in bed with the victim, testified at trial that the girl had admitted to her that she was terribly frightened by the movie. And the defense at trial was, look, this molestation didn't happen. This girl was living a vivid nightmare caused by this Paranormal Activity movie. And for the jury, for you to understand how a movie like this could frighten a teenage girl into believing something like that, you just need to see it for yourself.
But did some testimony come in giving a general description of the film?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
And, I might say in that regard that we've, you can imagine that I tell you that there's a big shark that's going to bite, some fishermen on a boat, that you know what the movie is, but you have no idea what the psychological effect is going to be until you've seen the horror scene in context with all the background music and the setting leading up to it to really appreciate the magnitude of the fright that could appear. So this is a case, literally, where a picture is worth 1,000 words. The judge, now, if this had been a witness that took 90 minutes, and the defense counsel said, Your Honor, I've got an additional witness 90 minutes long, there wouldn't even be an issue here. The court would have let them testify. We're not talking about delaying the trial for days. This is a movie. A theater movie that runs probably between 90 minutes and 2 hours. So it's not a question of unnecessarily delaying the trial, and it's not a question of raising or having watched the issue, as the state would have you believe, for some irrelevant or manufactured purpose. The defense was, and he argued this in opening statement, he argued to the judge, and he referred to it in closing argument. Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, this molestation didn't happen. This girl was terrified because of watching Paranormal Activity, which involved a scene in which a girl probably of similar age was also molested.
Was there an argument about the similarity between the allegations and the actions in the movie?
Yes, Your Honor. I would have to pull the page and submit it to you, but at one point, Mr. Kahn, the defense counsel, said, you know, gave a description that this is a case in which the girl was in bed and was put, I can't remember the exact words, but put upon by some spirit.
So not just the movie, but the fact of the movie, but the similarity between
right.
the allegations and the...
Young girl in bed at night, you know, some molestation activity, girl has a bad dream, kind of movie that would cause somebody, you know, I guess, and unless you're a real fan of that genre, somebody that would, you know, have the reaction of being scared. So it's a plausible defense, and it was his defense. So this isn't just mere trial error. This becomes error of constitutional magnitude.
Was there any evidence in the record whether appellant watched the movie with the girls?
I believe the testimony was that the three girls had watched the movie alone. They were in the home downstairs watching the movie. The parents were elsewhere in the house. And the testimony regarding the movie, you know, again, that victim, her first statement about why she had to leave home that night was, you know, I had a nightmare. Now, at trial, the victim said, oh, that movie didn't scare me. But one of the other witnesses, whose initials are BD, testified that the girl had told her, you know, contemporaneously watching the movie, that the movie had frightened her. So there was a factual issue about whether or not she was scared. And there's a factual, the state, in their brief, instead of looking at all the testimony, their response as point of error is simply to recite what the victim says and then say, well, look, there's no issue because the victim was sure that it happened. That's not how you evaluate a defense. You look at the record as a whole. The girl says, in retrospect, it wasn't the movie that scared me. Contemporaneously, she had made remarks that it did scare. Whether or not the movie was sufficiently frightening and similar that a jury would believe it could have scared her, we won't know because the jury didn't get to see the movie.
Well, doesn't that go more towards your issue of potential fabrication as opposed to whether or not she was scared? In other words, that the factual allegations were perhaps so similar that she made up a story based on those facts that she saw in the movie.
She in watching that movie, it's possible that as she testified at trial, the movie had no effect on her. I'm reluctant to use the word fabrication because if you have... The idea is that you can have dreams that are so real that you can't distinguish reality from surreality, particularly the time you wake up. You're lost in the moment and you're not sure what happened to you. And when the person has that, it's not that they're consciously lying. It's, you know, they're mistaken, but they had a bad dream, and that's what the defense was trying to tell the jury. She had a bad dream. That's why it didn't really happen. There's no physical evidence of it. She had a bad dream. And that defense was effectively precluded because the judge would not let the jury watch the movie. Granted, there are not a lot of cases on this point, but I can't imagine a circumstance in which the content of the movie would be more important to the presentation of the defense than this. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Anton. Ms. Messerly.
May it please the court, Mr. Anton. First, I just want to thank you, the court, and Mr. Anton for allowing me to reschedule this hearing. I appreciate it. I'm going to start, obviously, with point one, where Mr. Anton started. And I want to address the question that you had, Justice Dofino. There is similarity of conduct. If you look in the record, and I'm talking about between the extraneous offense and the offense in this particular case, While in the extraneous offense, the stepdaughter, who was molested by appellant for I think about a period of 10 years, she did testify she was alone in her bed, but the similarities are that there were multiple people in this home. There's many similarities. In this particular case that we are talking about today, the defendant was in the bed with his wife. He left her bed. He went into his daughter's room where the victim, his daughter, and another young woman were in bed, and he molested her. And I think there was also a brother in the room next door. So there were people in this house. There were people around when this happened. That's the same case with the extraneous offense. In the extraneous offense with Amanda, the young stepdaughter, he left his wife's bed. It was a different wife. He left his wife's bed. He walked down the hall, and he molested his stepdaughter for a number of years. And I think in that case, in that situation, there was a brother.
So you're saying it does go to show opportunity to assault while other people are in the same bed with her,
No, I'm not going to say in the same bed with her, because we don't know if in Amanda's case there were ever other, maybe her friends were spending the night. We don't know. We don't have testimony about that. There was opportunity for him to molest CB, the victim in this case, when there were other people in the house, very close by. I mean, he did the very same thing. He waited till the young girls fell asleep. He creeped out of his wife's bed. He walked down the hall, and he molested a young woman. In this case, he did it twice. He came back again. So there are there are similarities between these two cases. Mr. Anton was talking about the defense opening statement. It was very, very clear, if you go back and read that, that the defense attorney was arguing that the appellant had no opportunity to molest this young girl because of the people in the house also, because there was a group of people in this house.
But it was more than in the house. It was in the bed, right?
Yes. Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Is there anything in the record that shows whether, okay, there were three to a bed, right?
Yes.
Where in relation to the other two?
There are. There is evidence of that. In the bed, the victim was on the outside. Another young woman, I think her initials are AH, she was on the inside, and the appellant's daughter was closest to the wall.
Okay.
So he touched the one, he molested the one that he had the closest access to. She was on the outside. I don't know of any case that says a limiting instruction precludes a court from actually finding, you know, that you can't find that there's error in the admission of evidence simply by a limiting instruction. I mean, he talks about the defense being that there was this scary movie and that there was that there was no opportunity, and that's his main defense. But he puts forward many other defenses as well. I'm sorry, I'm getting off topic here. What I wanted to say really is that there's just a lot of similarity of conduct here, but there's also other reasons that this extraneous offense evidence could have come in. I mean, he very much raises the defense of fabrication over and over and over. He says that, you know, she had this scary dream, and there are cases on point, and I've cited those in my brief, that actually say, you know, if you cross-examine someone about, wasn't this a dream, wasn't this a dream, or an opening statement, you call someone's allegation pure fantasy, that's fabrication. But even more than that, he cross-examined the little girl's mother and said, isn't it true that y'all are just going forward on this allegation because you want to file a multimillion-dollar lawsuit? So he was also, you know, saying that the mom and the daughter were kind of lying in order to file this multimillion-dollar lawsuit. If that's not fabrication, I don't know what is.
Well, but the jury was instructed to consider it only for opportunity, and you've shown that why it would be admissible for opportunity, because there were allegations of similar activity with other people present.
Yes, ma'am.
In the room, in the house.
Yes, ma'am.
In the middle of the night.
And I do think it's admissible for that reason. I just think there's other reasons as well. And I think, you know, identity is another reason. He challenged CB's identification of him as the person who perpetrated this crime. He said, is it possible somebody else was in the house? Is it possible somebody else came in the room? You know, what is your vision? How could you see? Do you know what your, have you ever been told that you're legally blind? I mean, he cross-examined her pretty vigorously on her identification of Pellant as the person who committed the offense. So for that reason, you know, there were other reasons that this evidence could have come in, this extraneous evidence.
But what about the trial judge's limitation of the jury's consideration of that evidence to opportunity? How does that preclude us from considering or determining whether there was another reasonable basis for it?
I don't think so, Judge. I've never come across a case like that, and it certainly doesn't render the evidence unadmissible for these other purposes. I mean, if it would have been admissible, as the law says, at the time that the court made a ruling, if it would have been admissible for any other purpose, it's deemed to be admissible even if it's admitted for a wrong purpose. The cases say that. And so even if the trial court admitted it incorrectly, it's still going to be admissible. So if it had been admitted, say, incorrectly, which I don't believe it has, I think opportunity is a valid reason to admit this extraneous offense evidence, and it could have been admitted for fabrication or it could have been admitted for identity purposes, a limiting instruction is certainly not going to make it inadmissible, if that makes sense. Because if that was one of the reasons that wasn't raised, but it could have been, it's still legally admissible. Does that make sense? I have to admit I don't have a case on that either. I don't, as Mr. Anton said. And I could certainly look for one, and I'll be happy to do that. But the overriding principle is that if it would have been admissible for one purpose, even if it wasn't admitted by the judge for that purpose, it would have been admissible. So I don't think a limiting instruction is going to preclude that from being admissible later, or for y'all determining that it would have been admissible.
And aren't there multiple cases that in general speak to the appellate court's ability to affirm on other basis, but do limit us on reversing on different basis?
Yes, ma'am. That's true. I want to talk about point number five, and that's the trial court's denial of admitting the movie, or letting the jurors watch the movie. And I'm going to take a little issue with the way that the defense attorney characterized the evidence. If you go back and look at the record, BD, that's the appellant's daughter, she was a defense witness, and she did describe the movie pretty carefully, pretty thoroughly. And at no point did she talk about any molestation scene. At no point did she talk about any spirit or any ghost molesting anyone. The closest maybe she got to that was a spirit took a blanket off a man and a woman, not just a woman, a man and a woman who were in bed. So at no point was there any discussion that I could find in the record at all about anything in the movie regarding molestation.
And doesn't that make it more problematic that the jury didn't get to see the movie?
I don't think so, Judge, because I don't think that the defense attorney, it was his burden to show the nexus between the movie, the content of the movie, and her belief that she had been molested.
Did the judge watch the movie in camera to see whether it was admissible?
I do remember there was some discussion in the record about that, and I think he did, and maybe Mr. Anton can answer that question. I remember there being some discussion about that, but I'm not positive. The movie was admitted into the record. I know that. I'm not sure.
We'll get to watch the movie.
Well, I'll tell you, I don't think you're going to find any evidence of any molestation in there.
Both sides are invited to provide the popcorn.
I also want to talk about CB saying that she was scared because she had watched a movie, and I hope that you caught this in the record. AH, the girl who was in the middle, the girl who was not appellant's daughter, of course, wasn't the victim. She talks about CB, the young victim, waking her up, and that she describes CB as just hysterical. She said that CB texts her, because they don't want to wake up the other girl, the appellant's daughter, texts her and told her what happened. Shortly after that the appellant had molested her. Shortly after that, the appellant did walk into the bedroom. I think it was about 5 o'clock in the morning. The girl that was in the middle, the other friend, she testifies, this is her testimony, she said, you know, he came in the room and I just said, we're going home because we're scared of the movie. She said, I created that lie, I made that up for an excuse for us to get out of the house. CB admits in her testimony that she just kind of went with that lie. She just said that because she wanted to get out of the house. She was 14 years old. She'd been molested 2 times. So she went with that lie and admitted it was a lie as an excuse to get out of the house. She always maintained, and Mr. Anton didn't mention this, she had seen the movie before at a theater. She testified she wasn't scared of the movie. The movie just didn't have any big impact on her. She does admit that, yes, she said she was scared of the movie just to get out of the house, but that wasn't even her original, that wasn't her lie. That was her friend's. Her friend came up with that story. And if you look at her testimony, I think it's A.H., if you look at A.H.'s testimony, you'll see where she said that, that she was the one who came up with that. Another thing I want to say is the defense wasn't precluded really from using this movie as a defense. All through the record, he cross-examined CB about this movie. He asked BD to describe the movie. So there is a lot of testimony in here about the movie, and it's obvious that that was one of the defenses he was relying on, not the only one. He had multiple defenses. He had a defense that they were after money, as I said earlier, that the family was trying to sue this appellant to get a multi-million dollar settlement. He also said that she dreamed it, or that she couldn't see who he was when he came into the room. These are things that I discussed earlier. But he had multiple defenses, plus the fact that he really was not constitutionally prohibited. I mean, his constitutional rights were not violated. He was able to cross-examine the victim regarding her reaction, her fears, her thoughts about this movie.
Shelley, if this had been a murder case and y'all hadn't been allowed to put in the crime scene photographs or the crime scene video, would you feel like a description was enough?
Well, I think that your question is kind of assuming that this movie actually had this impact on her. I mean, the crime scene is actually where the offense took place and does really set up a visual for you of what happened. I'm not going to, I don't think
this... Set up a visual of what really was or really was not in that movie, wouldn't it have?
Well, what if she had watched, I mean, if she had watched a comedy, would we be saying here that the comedy,
you said
affected
that
her?
Talking about it was enough, was the same as seeing the movie itself, but the state doesn't feel that way about its crime scene.
I understand what you're saying, Judge. But what I don't think that we heard from the defense, and what I don't understand, is what was in the content of this movie that would actually have made it relevant to show that there was some nexus to her thought that she was being molested. Because I said there's no description, there's no testimony in this record that there was any kind of molestation scenes, anything like that in this movie. And the only evidence we have is that that she wasn't scared of this movie and it didn't have any effect on her at all. And that the statement that she was scared wasn't even her own originally, it was somebody else's. So I understand what you're saying, but I think the crime scene photos is relevant, obviously, and would be very relevant in a murder case. I just don't think we have that nexus here in this situation with the movie and her allegations that she's been molested. If there are not any other questions, the state will just rest on its brief.
All right.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Ms. Messerly. Mr. Anton.
Let me make some very, very brief reference to the record in terms of the questions that are asked. Page 6, volume 4. This is the defense counsel's description of the when he proffers the movie. He says, the complainant was actually experiencing a nightmare from watching the movie Paranormal Activity. The similarities are so close between the movie and the type of nightmare that the woman in the movie was possessed by a demon who would attack her when she went to bed, when she was in bed at night, in bed with her boyfriend. Like, you feel it's absolutely essential for us to do that. So, as, again, Justice Daufner pointed out, I mean, what you have here is a person in bed with other people at night, and according to the movie, the spirit molests her while she's in bed with somebody else, which is exactly what happened here. And that's the best description that we have of the content of the movie and the similarity, aside from watching the movie, which the court did not permit the jury to do. Now,
did the judge watch the movie?
Your Honor, I was looking for that feverishly during her argument. It's my recollection that the judge did say he would review it, but I can't find that in the record, and I'm not absolutely certain of my recollection on that point. Now, in terms of the...
Did y'all find it?
Okay. In terms of whether or not Amanda was molested while other people were present, I'm sorry, the extraneous victim, page 264, volume 4. This is in the sub rosa hearing. Defense counsel asks, now each of these times, did anybody come into the room to respond to these screams? No. Out of the 2,340 times you alleged you were abused, did anybody ever come into the room or knock on the door, make any inquiry? Answer, there was one time my mom came in and he was by my bed. I had my pants on. So a man, the other extraneous victim, it's clear from the testimony, she's saying that she was molested 2,340 times when nobody else was around. The record's clear that there's no similarity between the conduct involving the extraneous victim and the conduct involving the victim at trial. Now, in regard to the admissibility of the movie, this is a defense. And you don't judge whether or not a defense testimony is admissible by whether or not the complainant agrees with it. I'm certain the complainant at trial said, no, it didn't happen. The defense is entitled constitutionally to confront her and to point out that her version may not be true, that there are other witnesses who said that she was scared and that this movie is the type that make her scared. So I'm not sure what the state's urging in terms of the relevancy of the movie. It was his defense. And it matters not that they don't consider it important. It's what weight the jury would put on it. Now, and finally, in regard to the question I think that Chief Justice Livingston asked about their other cases that say if you admit evidence for one purpose, you can use it for another. Yes, that's the general rule. But there's no rule that says what they're asking this court to do is to find essentially that there's evidence that supports the conviction on a theory that was never presented at trial. They couldn't very well come into the Court of Appeals at this point and argue that somebody's guilty as a party if the party charge was never submitted. The charge that was submitted said, you can only consider this evidence for one purpose, opportunity, nothing else. And I'm not aware of any cases that allow the state to go around the jury charge now on something that they could have very well brought up at the time of trial. I think my time is concluded. Thank you.
Any questions?
Thank you.
All right, thank you.
Yes, ma'am.
Oh. Volume 4, page 6 at the very top.
Oh, okay. All right.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Anton, Ms. Messerly, Mr. Gibson. Thank you for being here. We appreciate your arguments today. Your case is now submitted. And the court, having no further cases on the docket, it will be adjourned.
All right. The Honorable Court of Appeals for the 7th District of Texas now stands adjourned.